Chapter 28. Austin arrived 3 minutes before his appointed meeting time with Aguirre's. After leaving Perlmutter's house, Austin drove down Embassy Row. The gods that look over Washington drivers were smiling, and he found a parking space with no trouble. He walked along Pennsylvania Avenue until he stood in front of a square-built building that consisted of several dark glass stories grafted onto some old Washington houses. Austin read the sign next to the front door and wondered if he had the wrong address. Given the troubles the Aguirre's family had had with the Spanish authorities through the centuries, the last place he would have expected to find Balthazar was the Embassy of Spain. Austin gave his name to a security guard at the door and was passed on to the receptionist, who punched out a number on her intercom phone and spoke in Spanish to someone on the line. Then she smiled and, in a lovely accent that evoked visions of Castile, said, "Mr. Aguirre is with the ambassador. He'll be with you in a moment." A few minutes later, Aguirre came strolling out of a hallway. Aguirre had shed his blue sweatsuit and black beret and was impeccably dressed in a dark gray suit that would have cost Austin a week's pay. Even the best of tailors couldn't hide the peasant hands and sturdy physique. He was talking to a snowy-haired man who walked beside him, hands behind his back, head lowered in thought as he listened intently to what the Basque was saying. Aguirre saw Austin and waved at him. The two men broke off their conversation, parting with warm handshakes and smiles. Aguirre strode over to where Austin stood and wrapped an arm around his shoulder. "Mr. Austin," he said cheerfully, "how nice to see you again. I'm sorry I didn't introduce you to the ambassador, but he was late for a meeting. Come this way." Aguirre led Austin down a hallway to a door into what had been a drawing room in one of the old houses that were part of the embassy complex. The centerpiece was an oversized marble fireplace, and the room itself was comfortably appointed with plush rugs and heavy dark wood furniture. Oil paintings of Spanish rural scenes decorated the walls. As they took their seats, Aguirre evidently noted the wondering look on Austin's face because he said, "You look puzzled, Mr. Austin." Austin saw no reason to beat around the bush. "I'm surprised to find you here. A man accused of being a Basque terrorist within the walls of the Spanish embassy." Aguirre didn't seem offended. "You have obviously looked into my background, which I expect. So you know that the accusations have not been substantiated. Still, I noticed that you're not wearing your black beret." Aguirre gave out a booming laugh. "In deference to my hosts, I have shed my chapeau, although I miss wearing it. I think that some in this building might think I had a bomb under the beret, and their nervousness would interfere with our work."
"Which is?"
"To peacefully settle the Basque problem once and for all. That's a tall order after hundreds of years of conflict. I'm confident it can be accomplished."
"What happened to your ancestral quest?"
"The past and the present are inseparable in this cause. The Basque separatists want a homeland. The Spanish government has experimented with autonomy with unfortunate results. If I find the relics I am looking for, their discovery could set off an emotional wave of Basque nationalism. I know my people. It would tear Spain apart."
"So you have suddenly become very important to the Spanish government?"
He nodded. "I have met with high-level officials in Madrid who asked me to inform your State Department people of the situation and assure them I am not a terrorist. I have agreed, once I find the relics, to put them in safekeeping."
"What's to prevent you from going back on your word?"
The Basque frowned, and a dangerous expression came to his dark eyes. "It is a logical question, and one the Spanish government also asked. I told them that I will honor the memory of my ancestor who was chosen to be the guardian of the relics.
In return, the Spanish government will take graduated, meaningful steps toward Basque autonomy.
You're using the relics as leverage.
He shrugged. I prefer to call it a solution that takes into account our mutual interests.
Not a bad deal, considering the fact that you don't have the relics.
A technicality, he said, the broad smile returning. I have unearthed information on the sea routes my ancestor took to the New World. The Basques were in the Faroes as early as 875. After stopping at the Faroes, Diego would head for Newfoundland or Labrador. There is ample precedent for this theory. My people fished for cod and whales off North America as far back as the Middle Ages.
I've read that Cabot found Indians using words that could have had a Basque origin.
No doubt about it, he said, his face flushing with excitement. My research indicates that there are some unexplored caves near Channel Port au Basque in Newfoundland. I will rejoin my yacht there as soon as I clear up my business here, and I am convinced that before long I will hold the sword and horn of Roland in my hands.
Austin paused, wondering how he could gently break the news before deciding that it could not be done.
There may be a problem, he said.
Aguirre's eyed Austin warily.
What do you mean?
Austin handed over an envelope containing a copy of the Blackthorn manuscript.
This material suggests that the relics may not be where you think they are.
Austin proceeded to lay out the story Perlmutter had told him. As Aguirre's listened, storm clouds seemed to move in and perch on his brow.
I know of St. Julian Perlmutter through my own research. He is highly respected as a sea historian.
There is none more knowledgeable.
Aguirre slammed a fist into his palm. I knew Diego wasn't killed by Bracero.
There's more, Austin said. He handed Aguirre the news clip detailing the interview with the Zeppelin survivor.
I still don't understand, the Basque said after reading the article.
Oceanus is the owner of the Zeppelin that found your ancestor's boat locked in the ice. Aguirre saw the connection immediately.
You believe that Oceanus has the sacred relics in its possession?
It's a good bet if you follow the chain of evidence. I have a confession to make. An Oceanus security guard blew up my boat with a hand grenade.
And I must confess that I never believed your story about engine fumes.
While we're in a confessing mood, Austin said, maybe you can tell me why your men followed me to Copenhagen.
A precaution? To be frank, I didn't know what to make of you. I knew from your identity card that you were with Numa, but I didn't know why you were poking into the Oceanus operation, and assumed it must be an official mission.
My curiosity was stirred, so I decided to keep an eye on you. You made no effort to hide your movements. My men happened to be nearby when you were attacked.
How is the young lady you were with, by the way?
She's fine, thanks to the alertness of your men.
Then you're not angry at being followed?
Not at all, but I wouldn't like to see you make it a habit.
I understand.
Aguirre paused in thought.
Am I correct to assume the men who attacked you were from Oceanus?
That seems a safe conclusion. The attackers resembled the guards I encountered at the Oceanus operation in the Faroes.
Oceanus tried to kill you twice.
Be careful, my friend. They may try again. They already have.
Aguirre didn't ask for details, and it was obvious he had other things on his mind. He rose from his chair and paced the room, Blackthorn's manuscript clutched in his hand. The people here must not know of this material. Without the relics, the Spanish government will lose its incentive to move on Basque autonomy. But this goes beyond political matters, he said in a hollow voice. I have failed my ancestor, Diego, by not finding the relics. There may still be a way. Aguirre stopped his pacing and fixed Austin with a penetrating stare. What are you saying? We're both interested in nailing Oceanus to the wall. Let's talk about it, taking account, as you said before, of mutual interests. Aguirre hiked his bushy eyebrows, but his face remained impassive. Then he went over to a liquor cabinet and brought back two small glasses and a bottle of greenish-yellow liquor. He poured the glasses full and handed one to Austin, who recognized the distinctive scent of Izara. An hour later, Austin slid behind the wheel of his car. He wondered if he had made a deal that might come back to haunt him, but he trusted his instincts, which were all he had to go on at this point. He sensed that Aguirre was devious but principled, and since they shared the same goals, it would be foolish not to form a loose alliance. He checked his cell phone and saw that there were two calls. The first was from the Trouts. He was relieved to hear from them. He knew from working with them on the special assignments team that Paul and Gamay were able to take care of themselves, but at the same time, they had gone looking for Oceanus without knowing how dangerous their mission might be. Gamay answered his call. She and Paul had returned from Canada a few hours before and dropped their luggage off at their townhouse. Then they had gone to Numa headquarters to meet with Zavala, who was going to update them. Did you get inside the Oceanus operation? Austin asked. No, Gamay said, but we bumped into a few of their people. Gamay was being a little too casual. I know from personal experience that when you bump into Oceanus, it bumps back. Are you and Paul all right? We're fine. A slight concussion for me and a broken wrist for Paul. The cuts and bruises are healing nicely. Austin swore under his breath, angry at himself for putting his partners into danger. I didn't realize what I was getting you into. I'm sorry. Don't be. You only asked us to see what we could learn about Oceanus. It was our decision to go flying off to Canada and poke our noses in where they weren't welcome. It was worth the trip, too. We wouldn't have learned about the devilfish otherwise. The only devilfish Austin had ever heard of was the manta ray. Are you sure that concussion is on the mend? I've never been more clear-headed, Kurt. In all my years as a marine biologist, I've never encountered anything like this before. Paul calls it white death. Austin experienced a quick frisson as he recalled his brush with the large, toothy creature in the Oceanus fish tank. You can fill me in when I get there. He hung up and punched out Gunn's number. Hello, Rudy, he said, without the usual exchange of pleasantries. I think it's time we had a meeting with Sandecker.